House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 12th. The first item on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2302. Ms. Sabell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2302 extends the amount of time a county or city has to seek reimbursement from a person committed to a local correctional facility. We have an amendment, a dash one amendment, that you should have in your possession. And on this bill, we are waiting for the fiscal impact statement, so we will be unable to work it today.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Marquis.
I don't have a dash one. I got a dash two.
Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association today testifying in support of House Bill 2302, which I believe is a pretty simple bill. Current law only allows for a one-year statute of limitations when cities and counties are trying to collect reimbursement from individuals released from correctional facilities. Under this bill, we would change the statute of limitations, actually under the amendment, from the current 1 year to 6 years. Hopefully that's what the amendment says. I haven't actually seen it yet, but hopefully that's where we're at. Oftentimes, when somebody's released from a correctional facility, it takes the individual some time to reestablish themselves within the community. And often, from the local government standpoint, if a repayment plan is set up and broke, it's often too late for that local government to bring action against the individual. Under current law, the person who owes this debt is already allowed to present evidence to the court if an action is brought on their ability to repay the debt, and the court is required to take this evidence into account when they establish the judgment. Due to this short statute of limitation, current law limits the ability of a local government or their agent to be flexible in working out repayment plans. We feel this is a reasonable approach to allow more flexibility and make it easier for local governments and the individuals to work out repayment plans and collect these funds for the local government. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Shields.
Mr. Markey, how did you arrive at the figure of 6 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, it was our intent when we had originally drafted or asked for the request of the bill to be silent on the statute of limitations, which would fall to the automatic six-year statute of limitations. In the first draft, it came back and said at any time. There was some question as to what that would mean, and probably means at any time. So that's why we drafted the amendment back to the 6 years.
So that's standard operating procedure in other parts of the statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's pretty standard along collection statutes, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, we do not have the fiscal back, so we won't be able to work that, so close the public hearing on House Bill 2302 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2343.
House Bill 2343 would modify the definition of mentally incapacitated as it applies to sex offenses. You have a rather lengthy background. I'd be happy to entertain any questions you have regarding the SMS. Otherwise, we cannot work this one. Again, the fiscal has not been completed.
Thank you. Call the first panel of Craig Stalk, Representative Gelser, and Christine Herman, please.
My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, and two people who live in Linn County. They are very well represented. I am very pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2343, which I introduced into the House on behalf of former Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. What this bill does is help the state of Oregon join the vast majority of other states in the nation in recognizing that there is never, ever a circumstance in which a woman or a man deserves to be raped. If we have a law that states that if you are so mentally incapacitated that you are unable to make a decision, it should not matter how you came to be in that state. The fact that you are in a state that makes you unable to consent is enough. Under current law, if a victim is sexually assaulted while she is intoxicated, evidence of the victim's intoxication and the offender's knowledge of a victim's intoxication are not allowed into evidence if the alcohol was voluntarily consumed by the individual. Therefore, if a predator knowingly assaults an intoxicated victim, that predator is not held accountable. To the contrary, we instead reward that predator for good victim selection. I'll give you a real-life scenario. A man watches a woman stumble out of a bar. She hasn't had just a couple of glasses of wine. She is extraordinarily intoxicated. He offers to give her a ride home, and once there, waits for her incapacitation to continue, and then sexually assaults her. Under current law, the prosecutor could not use the fact of her mental incapacitation as evidence of a lack of consent, simply because she made the choice to consume the alcohol. If that same circumstance happened and he had slipped something into her drink to put her in that same mental state, then that evidence could be used. House Bill 2343 simply closes the loophole in the sexual assault statute so that evidence of a sex offender's knowledge of a victim's mental state during the assault can be presented in court to show that the defendant knew the victim was incapable of consenting. Rather than focusing on the behavior prior to the assault, this change would focus on what the offender knew about the victim's ability to consent. To be clear, these cases will still be extraordinarily difficult to prove. This bill is about the definition of what mental incapacitation is. The defense can still raise the issue of whether or not the offender themselves were incapacitated to recognize the incapacitation of the other, or if the offender had a developmental disability or some other thing that impeded their ability to understand the lack of capacity for the victim to consent. Unfortunately, at trial, the whole issue of the victim consuming alcohol or participating voluntarily in an activity that led to her incapacitation will still be considered by the jury, and she will still suffer under our stereotypes that continue to permeate throughout our culture that lead us to believe that sometimes a woman is asking for it or she has made choices that put her in a place where she deserves to be raped. This does not, unfortunately, take that away. It simply allows the evidence to be presented. I ask you to give this bill serious consideration. Please remember that it's a definitional bill, that this is something that does bring Oregon into line with the majority of the states that recognize it is never okay to have sex with a person who is not capable of consenting. A woman or a man can never do anything that causes them to deserve to be raped. I hope that you will consider this bill. I hope that you will support it so that we can offer these victims the protection that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Herman?
Yes, thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. As a matter, just to give you a little bit of background on where this bill came from, the Sexual Assault Task Force is a body consisting of about 225 people from across the state in various professions. And this particular bill came about after members of the criminal justice system expressed concern about a number of victims who were not receiving adequate amounts of justice. A similar bill was introduced by the Oregon District Attorney's Association in 2007. It did not get out of committee. Since that time, we've worked with the Sexual Assault Task Force members, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the ACLU, and members of other groups that have interest in this type of legislation. We took some of those concerns into account, and that accounts for your Dash 1 amendment that you have before you. We believe that amendment does make the bill much clearer, allows for, no longer is there confusion about vagueness of the language, and we appreciate their input in coming up with what we believe is a much more concise bill. In a nutshell, this change would amend the definitional section under the sex offense section of Oregon Revised Statutes 163-305. It would make mental incapacitation language mirror the language of the two definitions that flank it, mentally defective and physically helpless. In each of the crimes of rape first degree, sodomy first degree, sexual abuse first degree, and unlawful sexual penetration first degree, there's a manner by which the crime can be committed based on the incapability of the victim to consent by either mental defectiveness, physical helplessness, or mental incapacitation. Because sex crimes in Oregon, like in most states, are general intent crimes, there's no mens rea element in the sex offense. To account for the usual requirement of notice to the defendant, however, the legislature provided an affirmative defense that's found in ORS 163-325 that specifically applies to these three types of cases where lack of consent is based on one of those three means, including mental incapacitation. The affirmative defense allows the defendant to aver that at the time of the offense, he or she did not know of the facts or conditions that were responsible for the victim's incapacity to consent. And this is important because, of course, no one wants to see a person convicted of a crime if that person didn't realize what was happening. And that's what the affirmative defense is there to guard against. The current definition of mental incapacitation allows the defendant's guilt to be determined not by his acts, but by the behavior of the victim. That's incongruent with any other criminal statute. And I would ask you to think about this in terms of another crime, let's say burglary. If you were to leave your door unlocked of your home, that may in fact be a reckless thing to do. It may be not wise for you to leave your door unlocked. But if someone were to come into your house and burglarize your house, I ask you if you believe that that person should be held accountable for burglary, or if that person should be excused because you did something that perhaps made you more vulnerable to crime. What we know is that sex offenders pick victims, and they pick victims based on victims' vulnerability, accessibility, and perceived lack of credibility. One of the best ways to achieve an accessible, vulnerable, an incredible victim is to find one who is very intoxicated. Notably, the current definition misses the most important point. That is, it is the fact that the victim is so vulnerable, not the manner by which she became so, that the rapist exploits. Because of that, we are asking for your support in telling Oregonians that there is never an excuse for rape, that it is never okay to take advantage of a person due to that person's state of vulnerability, regardless of how that vulnerability came about. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stahl.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee, or the committee. My name is Craig Stolk, and I'm a retired police officer from the city of Salem. I served 30 years, and I was a sexual assault investigator and homicide investigator for 23 of those years. And I wanted to take just a couple moments to express my support for Bill 2343. In my opinion, I found during the course of my career that the vast majority of sexual assault cases involving adults and young teens and older teens took place with the component of alcohol consumption to the point of extreme intoxication or drug intoxication on the part of the victims. And what I found during the course of my career, when I would compare that to other cases, including assault, robbery, or homicide, which are also crimes against persons, that in many of those type of cases, you'd also find that there was a component of intoxication on the part of the victim. And yet there's an incredible double standard for a sexual assault victim who has her case diminished as a result of her intoxication, when those same type of things are not taken into consideration with assault, homicide, and other types of persons, crimes, victims. The real issue that I see that takes place in sexual assault in particular is that laws exist to take care of vulnerable people, and intoxication is a form of vulnerability. There's no getting around it. And the fact is that people that are engaged in sexual assaults are predatory individuals, and I firmly believe that there's no such thing as an isolated event or a one-time offender. There are people that learn how to be offenders based upon their practice and past success. And the reality is these people are out amongst us in our community. I've investigated cases across the street at Willamette University where people that come from good family backgrounds, they're respected people in their communities, have engaged in the predatory behavior of waiting for people to become intoxicated to the point of not being able to defend themselves and then commit their sexual assaults. I would also suggest to you that from a law enforcement point of view, that this type of bill does not increase any sort of financial impact to the law enforcement community. Competent law enforcement agencies are already investigating these cases, and a tremendous amount of resources are put into these cases to try to prove and disprove these allegations and present them to the appropriate prosecutors as it currently exists.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Garrett.
Is there data or do you have a sense of how frequently we see cases where there's a dispute between the offender and the victim about, and the dispute basically centers on whether he knew that she was to the point of intoxication? In other words, he thought she consented and she says, no, I was too drunk.
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, thank you. First of all, we'll say that following us today will be several district attorneys who may have more specific information about that. What I can tell you is that as a former prosecutor myself, that is what every one of these cases is about. That is what the fact pattern boils down to in the end. And what we've proposed as a definitional change to the manner by which the person becomes incapacitated will not change that fact pattern. In other words, that's still going to be the question at trial in the vast majority of these cases.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a Dash 1 amendment was mentioned. It appears it did not make it back from LC drafter in time. So when you're looking at the proposed bill in front of you, and you look at line 16, and my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Furman, is that on line 16, the portion that reads, the sentence would finish, time of the alleged offense, everybody sees that? There would be a period there, and then all the language that fills out the rest of Section 4 would be struck by the amendment. So just put a line through all of that. That's what the amendment that's currently being drafted will reflect, and that is what I believe is being addressed today when they say Dash 1.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you, panel. Next, if I have Mr. Morris, Mr. Leek, and Ms. Amori.
Did you call for Mr. Norris?
I did. I have Norris, Leek, and Amori.
Okay. Two of us are going to be...
Okay, that's fine. You can bring an extra chair up, would be fine, or you can sit there. And you can start in any order. Please identify yourself for the record.
Would you like to start?
Sure. Hi. My name is Lisa, and I'm a Willamette student.
Lisa, you need your last name.
Imori.
Thank you.
Sorry. I'm a Willamette student, and I'm also the member of an organization on campus called the Sexual Assault Response Allies. We interact directly with survivors, and we provide support and information on resources for peers who have been victimized. So academics tells us that the purpose of law is to protect those who are vulnerable from those who take advantage of that vulnerability. Yet, as it stands, I am forced to look a survivor in the eye and tell her that at the very moment the law should protect her, it will instead take the defense of her rapist and place her character and actions on trial. The current law re-victimizes survivors who have the courage to come forward and hold the rapist accountable. Moreover, it sends a message to the community, particularly to predators, that there are circumstances under which it is okay for one individual to rape another. It's wrong and it's dangerous. And for these reasons, I ask you to really consider this bill.
Thank you.
My name is Cliff Leek.
I am also a Willamette student, and I am co-chair of Willamette University's Men Against Violence. And I'd like to express my support for the bill as well. The majority of rapes and sexual assaults are committed by men, but the majority of men are not rapists or abusers. Those of us who are not rapists or abusers, and those of us that support and love our communities, need this bill to pass for two reasons. The first reason is that the current legislation tells us that it is not our fault if we take advantage of someone in a vulnerable state. It tells us that that behavior is to be expected, reducing us to little more than animalistic impulses. I think more of men than that, and expect more than that. Our legislation should too. The second reason is that the current legislation contributes to an environment within which perpetrators believe that they can get away with taking advantage of someone in a vulnerable state. No one should be leading perpetrators to believe that they can get away with rape or sexual assault, and our legislation right now does exactly that. As a man that believes in the integrity of other men and cares deeply about the community around me, I need this bill to pass. It is time for us as a community and as a state to expect more from one another. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Dan Norris. I'm the District Attorney in Malheur County, Oregon, and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Chair Barker, members of the committee, the ODAA does support this bill for the reason that it doesn't matter why someone's incapacitated. What matters is what the offender did. And this bill does protect offenders who don't know the level of the incapacitation. All of these cases are still going to center around the conduct of the defendant, and we shouldn't have the conduct of the victim, whether or not she or he voluntarily consumed intoxicants or had them slipped to them. The overriding goal is we want to protect people who are vulnerable. So for that reason, the Oregon District Attorneys Association does support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have two more proposals. John Haroldson and Attorney General Kroger. Thank you for coming over, Attorney General. If you want to go ahead and start, just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm here to strongly support House Bill 2343. If I could put this in just a little bit of perspective, 50 years ago, it was very common for victims of rape or sexual assault to be victimized twice. They'd be victimized once during the crime. They'd be victimized a second time in the courtroom when it was very common for perpetrators to never be charged or to be released, acquitted, because not because of their conduct, which violated the law, but because of the conduct of their victim. People would allege that provocative clothing or voluntary intoxication shifts the responsibility from the rapist to the victim, and that they should be held accountable, and thus no crime has been committed. Over the last 50 years, we've seen a dramatic change in the law throughout the United States, in which the focus of attention is no longer on the conduct of the victim, how they dress, whether they've been drinking or using drugs, but focusing solely on that of the perpetrator and asking whether they committed a sexual assault. And I think it's important that we continue that trend. Unfortunately, Oregon right now is in the minority of states around the country. The majority of states have moved to the direction that's being proposed by this bill by making it irrelevant as to whether incapacitation resulted from voluntary intoxication or not. I think this is a very smart move for us to make in the law, and I want to point out that this will bring us not just into the majority around the nation, but we'll also make sure that Oregon law comports with all of our neighbors, Washington, California, Nevada, and Idaho, which have moved in this direction as well. I think this is a very good bill in helping to protect victims and a responsible thing for this legislature to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Haroldson, Benton County District Attorney, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2343. Coming from Benton County, we have a Pac-10 university that has many young people attending, obviously. And it's a point that's important to understand because we have so many people that are away from home for the first time in their lives. And along with that experience comes the excitement of being independent. And sometimes in the course of that, perhaps overindulging as part of the process that sometimes people go through. And although we work hard to deliver a message so that people aren't engaging in self-destructive behaviors, the reality is that young people, and we know from statistics, are going to test their independence to a degree. We live in a reality where there are those who are prepared to prey on those young people when they see them in a vulnerable state. Such is this reality now that there are actually genres or fetishes that celebrate taking advantage of an individual who's unconscious or intoxicated. And so this bill really underscores the lack of relevancy that as to how the victim reached a state of incapacitation, but rather focuses on the defendant and the defendant's conduct. And it's important to underscore in that notion that the state still bears the responsibility to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest legal standard in our courts, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted intentionally or knowingly or recklessly. But when we're talking about sex offenses, we're talking about somebody who's acting intentionally or knowingly in a particular case. That's a significant burden when you take into consideration that the argument can be made that even though the victim was incapacitated, that it was the perception of the defendant that the victim, in fact, was not incapacitated and was wanting to do something consensual, and therefore they could not form the requisite mental intent, the criminal intent, to commit the crime. This change wouldn't change that battle, and that's the interesting point there, because statistics will also bear out that the majority of these crimes are not committed by a stranger who suddenly abducts an individual, although that does happen, but the majority of cases involve individuals who are able to build a level of trust so that they can isolate their victim. They may be encouraging them to drink, and at that young age, that victim may even be thinking that they're making the choice when they're responding to a peer pressure. We have seen cases that involve serial date rapists, where in some cases they use flat-out force. In other cases, it's very subtle. And we file motions to introduce other bad acts, as many as 10. And when you look at them in their full context, you can appreciate that you have a predator who is seeking to victimize young women. And in the course of that, if you were to take a look at one case by itself, and you had the obligation of having to get into some sort of debate and evidentiary contest about the manner in which the person came to be incapacitated, it takes away from the issue. And the issue is the responsibility of the individual who's committing the rape. Now, keep in mind that in the majority of these cases, these are individuals whose intent is not to be caught. That's why they're looking for someone who may be passed out, who isn't going to be able to offer any evidence at all about the case. So in the course of that plan, when they are caught, they find themselves in a position where they can claim that the victim acted in a certain way and the victim may have no recollection of it whatsoever. It's a difficult position to be able to respond to if you're a victim of such a crime, let alone enter into a debate as to how they became incapacitated in that process. So it's important to understand that it's unlikely that you're going to have somebody that engages in this type of conduct, and then when they're talking to the police, they're going to say, you know what, this is my strategy. I'm going to try to find some sneaky way to get this person so intoxicated or incapacitated or slip them a roofie, and then once they're there, I'm going to exploit them. We don't see a whole lot of confessions like that, and in fact, I can't remember any. So we're left to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt. Our job is still going to present the same level of challenge without having to pour our attention into debating the issue of the victim's role in that level of intoxication. I think one further point to underscore, in looking at the date rape drug cases, you'll see drugs that are used to incapacitate which are difficult to detect in the victim's urine.
Or the blood test.
Because they dissipate so quickly. So there you have someone who's incapacitated, but you have no answer for the question as to how they got there. For all the reasons previously stated and for the reasons that I've expressed to you, I support House Bill 2343. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Yes, Representative Stegall.
And either of you can answer this. I'm assuming the Dash 1 amendments don't change your support of the bill in any way, shape, or form.
John Harrelson speaking now.
I have to admit, Representative Sigler, that I have not seen the Dash 1 amendments, so I can't comment.
Thank you.
Garrett.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for the testimony. I really appreciate that. And I agree that the statute as it's currently worded is not right. And I think I support this bill. But I'm struggling with something. Maybe you can help me sort it out. It seems to me that if we make this change, we've talked mostly about the predators who we're trying to capture with this legislation. It seems to me we are also probably going to bring within the sweep of this some men, boys, who thought they were proceeding with consent. And I know that's a disputed issue now, and this doesn't change that. But I guess what I'm asking is, given that likelihood, and I would say it's probably an inevitability, I note that if we make this change, we will be treating those cases where a person who, say, believes he's acting with consent, loses that issue at trial and is convicted. That person will be guilty of rape in the first degree, which is the same crime as someone who commits a rape by forcible compulsion. And I just want to put out there for consideration whether that should that concern us? Is that appropriate? Is that worth thinking about? Are those two situations truly involving the identical type of culpability?
My answer is absolutely we should be concerned about ensuring that the public is protected in circumstances where someone is essentially raping an unconscious person. Because to take somebody who's incapacitated, that doesn't matter whether they're just completely catatonic or whether or not they are still uttering something, but if we've truly proven that this person is incapacitated, it definitely deserves to be within the same rank. Because ultimately, what you're describing, the concerns with regards to the scenario where you have someone who both people are intoxicated and perhaps they've misread the situation, we deal with those arguments all of the time. And quite frankly, it results in cases where a crime has likely occurred not being prosecuted simply because we are required to be able to prove that that person acted knowingly. In other words, that that person was aware that the other person is incapacitated. And that's significant. I think one of the things we have to be careful about is not to be drawn in to the stereotype of a misunderstanding that takes place over some beers on a college campus. That is certainly something that may happen. But by the same token, just because it happens doesn't mean that we should not afford some protection to people who are essentially, when we say incapacitated, not able to say no. So somebody's doing what they want to, and they're left with that for the rest of their lives.
Mr. Harrelson, do you have cases when you were saying that about inability to fight back, do you have cases where people are forcibly raped, where an argument's made, well, they're not beat up enough to prove that they were forcibly raped, they didn't fight hard enough? Are those same kind of arguments, does that show up in a rape case?
Regularly.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Krieger.
The person who's committing the crime, as we heard, probably men 90% of the time, and they're under the influence to quite a degree. What is their culpability of understanding the condition of the other person, the victim?
The person who's committing the crime has defenses available related to their level of intoxication that may go to whether or not they can form the requisite mental intent. In other words, were they so intoxicated that they weren't able to form the criminal intent? And I'll give you a quick example of that. Say you have an individual who is walking down the street after getting quite intoxicated, and they live on a military base, so all the houses look the same, but they're painted slightly differently. That individual thinks they're going into their own home, but they go into somebody else's home. You could argue that that person doesn't have the mental intent, the criminal intent, to commit criminal trespass or a burglary. On the other hand, if you have an individual who's on their way home, and they decide, you know, with the alcohol they've had to consume, that they're going to go into the neighbor's house and check out their big screen TV. In that scenario, the person has formed the criminal intent, and just because they got more courage from the alcohol they consumed, it doesn't change that. So in either case, on the intoxication issue, that is an evidentiary matter that goes, that may cut against the state and certainly presents challenges for us in being able to prove, under those conditions, did that person act intentionally or knowingly in committing that act?
Okay. Further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
I follow up to that, and I appreciate Representative Gelsinger bringing forward the bill. I haven't said that yet. I've wondered if too much commentary from our chair not led to a question can be sycophancy, but really do appreciate your leadership on these section of issues, and it's an honor to serve with you. And thanks, Attorney General Kroger, for your testimony, everybody. This is a necessary and deeply unpleasant matter, and I appreciate your testimony. The question, follow-up question I have, so that when I heard his question, what I was thinking of, you have two really drunk people, right? One of them is victimized. What is the other, almost certainly male, who is also drunk? What is there, which is a little different than you're walking down the street, going to the wrong house analogy, is the fact that they were also drunk in that scenario, you know, how does that play evidentiarily?
These questions can be a little bit challenging to answer because they remain abstract without more facts. Yep. In other words, if that's all the facts that were present, you would send your investigators out to get more information.
Yeah.
Was there an injury that resulted? You know, what were the surrounding circumstances? Were there witnesses? What statements were made about what happened? Because ultimately, you have to reach that burden of proof once again. And just because you have two people that are intoxicated and somebody's indicated that it was not a consensual situation, you still have to have evidence to be able to prove that.
Yeah.
Okay, further questions?
Thank you. And okay, last we'll call Chris Howard and Gail Meyer, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I want to preface my remarks by saying I'm a single mother raising a 13-year-old daughter who's quite tall and beautiful and developed, and so I can appreciate the concerns that come from the proponents of this bill. I really do. And I also want to echo Representative Smith's comments that these are difficult but necessary conversations. This bill is more than simply definitional. It does constitute a shift in burden, and perhaps that is exactly what the committee hopes to accomplish. My purpose here is to just highlight for you the ways in which the rubber will hit the road in some cases for you to decide really if that's what you intend to do. I would submit that there was a reason in 1971 why the Criminal Law Commission did structure the statute as it did. There are three instances by statute of ways in which a victim would be rendered incapable of consent. And two of them are mentally defective because of a mental disease or defect, or because of physical helplessness, either because of unconsciousness or in some other reason, physically unable to communicate and unwillingness to act. And so in that instance, I'm in my own mind thinking someone with cerebral palsy who's unable to communicate or something like that. As to those two conditions, mentally defective, physical helplessness, they're rather static conditions. Now, clearly if someone's unconscious, they're going to go in or out of unconsciousness, but generally it's not an ephemeral state that will shift during the course of an evening. What the 1971 legislature did when it crafted this statute, it looked at mentally incapacitation and it addressed alcohol and alcohol only in that context. And I think it did so in acknowledgement that during the course of an evening, the condition of one's sobriety will shift from one state to the next. And so how can you reasonably, in the context of the high stakes consequences of a rape trial, how can you really discern, A, the level of incapacity of the victim, and B, how obvious it was such that the defendant would know their level of incapacity? And so what the 1971 legislature did is they said, you know, we're going to look at what the defendant did. If the defendant made the victim incapable of consent because he, most likely, or she, slipped the alcohol to the victim or put in some drug, then we know, because that is an overt act of the defendant. It clearly shows calculation and design. And in that instance, it's clear and fair to say that that victim was rendered incapable. And so I think the 71 legislature was looking at, it drew a bright line. It looked at clear, overt conduct on behalf of the defendant, and they said, in that instance, we can say, because of that calculation and design on his behalf, that this victim was rendered incapable of consent. What the amendment does here, the bill and the amendment, is it now has mentally incapacitated. It does not anymore relate only to alcohol. It would relate to virtually incapacitation for any reason whatsoever. And it now will, in all instances, shift to the defendant the obligation of proving as an affirmative defense that he did not know of the conditions that would render the victim incapable. So in all instances now, it will be an affirmative defense on behalf of the defendant. How these cases will, how the statute will hit the road, everyone can come to this table here with their scenario facts, which proves their point. But there was a period of time in my career when I had a string of hot tub cases, and they almost all had very similar fact pattern. It was a group of individuals drinking at a bar, everyone drinking consensually, multiple couples pairing off, going back to someone's house who has a hot tub, the alcohol continues to flow. During the course of the evening, couples pair off. One goes to the gazebo, one goes to the bedroom, one goes by the side of the pool. There's various levels of sexual activity. Everyone goes home. And then at some point, that morning, the next day, whatever, a phone call is made to 911. Someone alleges that they were raped. So this is those sort of cases where it will be very difficult to discern. What was the level of incapacitation? What was the level of knowledge of the defendant? The level of sobriety can flow throughout an evening. It's not a static state. And what this bill will do is, in all instances now, it will be the defendant's burden to prove that he or she did not know of the victim's level of incapacitation. So that's the net effect of the bill. I point that out to the committee, and it's a policy choice for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Barker, members of the committee. My name is Chris Howard. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law for 23 years, almost that entire time as a defense lawyer, the last 15 here in the state of Oregon. I represent individuals charged with these types of crimes, these kind of cases specifically. And I can tell you that the statutes as they stand have never been an impediment for the prosecutors in the various jurisdictions here in the state that I've practiced in. from bringing charges and proving their case. Physical incapacitation is a classic example. If someone is so intoxicated that they are unable to physically fight back, to say no, to indicate to their assailant that they don't want to do this, that has been a classic case for the prosecutor to bring rape in the first degree and prove their case. If the person doesn't remember, there are forensic ways of proving the case. Physical evidence is left behind. This law changes, if this amendment, I should say, changes the law such that it's going to muddy the waters. I'm also a member of the Uniform Criminal Jury Instruction Committee for the State Bar. We have to craft instructions for these kind of things and then get them to judges. And judges then have to say, how do we implement them? I put this to you so that simply you understand that as a practitioner, I believe the law as it stands provides the protections that are there, that are being asked to be given for you. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Stigler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Ms. Meyer, I just want to be really clear. First of all, you are you citing what you believe the 1971 legislature believed, or do you have a body of legislative history that you've reviewed that substantiates what you have proffered here today?
Chair Barker and Representative Stigler, it's a hybrid answer. I've looked at and dealt with this statute in the context of my career defending cases, and at one point I did go through the 1971 legislature. What I've recited to you today is my best memory, right, understanding of that. I think it is clear in looking at the code that the definitions of mentally defective and physical helplessness are more static conditions, and that as currently drafted, the state of mental incapacitation dealt with alcohol and alcohol only. And my point being that the levels of sobriety can shift throughout the course of an evening.
But if, I'm going back many years because it's been a long time since I was very well aware of when these statutes were, some of the recrafting was done way back in 1971. Would it not be safe to say that to some degree the statutory definitions were contextual, i.e. the times, 1971, there were changes just beginning, but there were also a lot of, you can't look at these things in a static state, so to speak. You have to look at them in the context in which they were developed. And the times in 1971 were vastly different than the times, say, today. Wouldn't you agree?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, I would agree with you on that.
If I might do that again. Sure. I know. Habits are hard to break. Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just curious, do you believe that the Dash 1 amendments, is that something that you believe make, if you had your druthers and this was going to go forward, with or without the Dash 1 amendments?
Chair Barker and Representative Stigler, I've asked myself that question. I think the Dash 1 amendment probably is an improvement of the language in the original bill. I think its net effect is the same. The original bill said illness, alcohol, any other reason. By simply truncating any list at all, the net effect is still any reason. So, but to answer your question, I do think that if the committee is of the intention that it wants to pursue this course of action, then as between the two options, I think the A1 amendment is the better language.
And one more follow-up. Ms. Meyer. Ms. Meyer, and I don't want to get in, I'm not going to quibble with you on your view of shifting burdens. I have a little bit different opinion of that. But wouldn't you agree that as currently constructed, with the definition of mental incapacity, that the burden is squarely on the state to show that the victim, and we'll use that term, that the person who is the victim or the person saying that this was not a consensual act, that as it currently stands, that the burden is squarely on the state to show that the victim's incapacitation was due to an overt act by the defendant.
Mr. Barker, Representative Siegler, yes.
And therefore, essentially, that the victim was, quote-unquote, not to blame for the state of incapacitation.
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Steeler, yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Howard, the sex offender registration was implemented here in Oregon in 1989. For the length of time that you've been in practice, do you see an increase in the predatory behavior since that time? I mean, understanding that, we recognize that there was a serious problem going on throughout our state and throughout, you know, the country for what's happening, especially with the Walsh Act right now. But are you seeing clearly a planned intent-type overt act behavior from people since the last, we'll say, 20 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I would say no. I'd say there'd be a decrease in any kind of planning out. People act more impulsively in these situations. They're a predator in the sense that they pounce upon a situation, but they're not necessarily seeking that situation on a regular basis. It just happens, and they take advantage of it.
Okay, thank you.
In 1971, which was 38 years ago, we already kind of covered that things had changed. I mean, I can recall she was wearing hot pants, you know, she was wearing the short skirt, she's asking for it, and the testimony reminded me of a particularly brutal rape in Portland one time that I covered as a younger officer, never was young, but a younger officer with an older officer, and this woman had met some bikers, and not just kind of bikers, real bikers, at a bar and was drinking with them. They took her back and raped her and beat her up pretty good. And the guy, my sort of coach, saying, well, what do you expect? You're riding with bikers, so how do you know? And was going to not even take a report. And in my early days of police work, I'd seen police very reluctant to take reports from women in similar cases. I picked that up, and anyway, the case ended up in a conviction. But times have changed. And then, Mr. Howard, and I'm not challenging you, what you said, that the DAs don't seem to be deterred by the current law from prosecuting these cases. But in all honesty, do you know how many cases they don't take when they look at them? I mean, how many claims are made and they say we can't go with that because you don't have a case here?
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't answer that question.
Okay, thank you. Representative Shields.
In these particular type of situations, this is exactly an area of the law where it would be really helpful, I think, if we had someone from the judiciary who could come up and tell us how this would play out in everyday court hearings, because I think the issue is not whether or not Gail and District Attorney Norris are standing in front of a jury debating this. I think the issue is what's going to happen in the plea negotiations. And maybe someone from the judiciary doesn't feel comfortable coming up to address this issue, but I think that I just want to get on the record for those who are out there that it sure would be helpful, because we've got one team telling us it's going to work this way and somebody else is telling us it's going to work another way. Those of us who've never been in a courtroom in these kinds of cases or seen a plea negotiation have no idea. And so I just want to make that statement.
Any further questions?
I had one question just to make sure I understand how the law currently works. Tell me if I'm wrong. In the hypothetical, the offender has actual knowledge that a woman is incapacitated, cannot consent. But she got there through her own voluntary intoxication. Under that circumstance, that person cannot be charged with rape in the first degree, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrett, my experience is that's not correct. If they can, under the physical helplessness subsection definition, I have seen those situations prosecuted.
So you've seen them come under the physical helplessness
that's correct.
Prong, not the incapacitation?
That's correct.
All right.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Representative Barker, I just want to follow up with a comment that you made and then to make two observations for the committee. With respect to there being charges that are not brought because the government recognizes it cannot sustain its burden, I have been in instances where, quite frankly, I've had prosecutors tell me they've had to bring the charge because they could not bring the charge if they had an allegation of rape being made forcefully by a complainant who says that's exactly what happened. So we actually, you know, basically tried the case in front of the grand jury, and the grand jury decided not to charge, but the prosecutor, district attorney, felt an obligation to bring the allegation once the complaint was made. I would only point out two things for the committee. Rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree are 300-month sentences, so the allegation of the charge itself is a huge game changer in terms of negotiation stance. And this is a state that does allow a non-unanimous verdict, 10-2. We're the only state in the new union that does that. So we do tolerate a fair amount of reasonable doubt in the verdict process itself.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, what this essentially does, this bill, if we were to pass this, would take away debate about how somebody got drunk. I mean, the rest of the facts is you're saying they bring them already. But now we wouldn't be arguing about, well, she drank on her own, or that kind of removes the question. So we're not going to argue about whether she did it herself or whether, I mean, obviously if somebody slips somebody a roofie, that's a whole different case than what we call voluntary intoxication.
My experience is that's never been the issue of how they got intoxicated.
Okay.
I'm not the only practitioner of law in this state, obviously.
No,
But it's the level of intoxication is the issue, not how they got to that level.
All right. Well, the slight difference would be if the accusation was that you tricked somebody or poured it down them, rather than they did it themselves.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions?
Just one last thing, Mr. Chair. I did talk to the representative from the judicial branch. She said she'd be happy to go back and talk to some of the staff and see if there are procedural issues that we might want to be aware of when we come forward with any amendments.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Geyer is asked to speak. Mr. Geyer, sorry.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Cortland Geyer. I'm a deputy district attorney over in Marion County. I'll try to just be brief. Just as I was listening to the testimony that just went, I wanted to correct, if I may, one fact. There was testimony that the sentence for rape in the first degree in the instance that we're talking about would be 300 months or 25 years. That is not correct. There was legislation, I think Representative Cameron is well aware, in 2006 that made it 25 years when the victim is under the age of 12 and the offender is at least 18 years of age. So acts of rape in the first degree committed against a child. In this case, what we're talking about are peer age sexual offenses. So I wanted to just to state that. And then briefly, it is the ethical duty of prosecutors only to commence a prosecution when we have a reasonable belief that there is a reasonable likelihood of conviction. That's the ABA standard in any event. And that's the standard that we employ at my office. So ideas where we might be instigating a prosecution against someone because we were maybe disgusted by the conduct, even in that instance, if we don't have that belief that there's a reasonable likelihood of conviction under the law, then we do not and should not prosecute. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. No other...
Mr. Vice Chair.
It's going to have to come back to the committee. We're not going to move it or anything. So it's... We're hearing it. We're hearing testimony. We're not arguing. We're not to argue testimony. Good. He has to make a decision.
No, you're going to make a decision.
First one today.
What's up?
We're receiving information.
Mr. Norris, please. Do you proceed under the physically helpless portion of the current bill?
You can, and I'm not going to use the quote we used in the office, but I've had cases where a victim has been vomiting and laying in pools of vomit and passed out. In those cases where they're totally passed out and they're not coming in and out of consciousness, we can proceed under the physically helplessness. The problem is that when they're in a state where they are semi-conscious and can move, it's very, very difficult, but they're certainly not able to protect themselves. And it comes down to, they're difficult cases because you're going to deal with the people at the party who some will say he or she appeared to be capable of consenting, and others who will say he or she was not. And those are the fact problems that we have. But this change in the language really goes down to, do we care how a victim became incapacitated?
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like to extend thanks to the two young people from Willamette University for having the fortitude and the courage to come and appear before this body today with your testimony.
Thank you, and thank all the witnesses. These are some tough issues to cover, but it needs to be done. Nothing further. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2343. Open a public hearing on 2344. Ms. Seville.
House Bill 2344 requires that sexually explicit property or material involving a victim of criminal conduct would remain in the control of law enforcement agency or the court throughout the criminal proceeding. Again, on this bill, we do not have a fiscal impact statement, so we cannot work it today.
Mr. Haroldson, Mr. Norris, and Mr. Geyer. Again, you go in any order, just be sure to remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Young colleague. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County and president of the ODAA. I have my written testimony. testimony, and so I'm going to have to publicly admit that I made a fairly serious mistake in a case that I did. You have the graphic facts. I'm not going to go into those any further, but I did provide these materials in discovery, just as I do most photographs that come out of my office. They were incredibly graphic and very difficult for my staff to reproduce. And at the end of the trial, the inmate who wanted these photos in the worst way had a request to his attorney that he wanted his file. And the file belongs to the client, and the defense counsel was under an ethical obligation to turn a copy of the file over to his client. And the client would have been allowed to have these images back, to post on the internet or do anything else the client wanted. Now, luckily, in this state, we have fine defense attorneys, and they promptly couldn't tell me what their client wanted, but they filed a motion to let the judge decide, which clued me into the fact that I needed to get a protective order. But if we wouldn't have had that in place, a defense attorney actually helping the prosecution, these files would have been turned over to someone who's been convicted of possessing these images twice in the past. And it makes a lot of sense not to rely on prosecutors who make mistakes or defense counsel who makes mistakes. These items should be treated as guns, knives, and drugs, because they're as harmful to the victim to have those images posted on the internet if someone makes a mistake than the original crime. And by keeping them in the possession of the law enforcement agency and allowing the defense any kind of opportunity to review them, to have their experts look at them, just like we do with DNA, just like we do with the guns, just like we do with the drugs, we put an added layer of protection to ensure that these items do not inadvertently make them or make it to the internet or to some other area where they can harm a victim. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2344.
Please identify yourself for the record.
John Haroldson, Benton County District Attorney. Thank you. It's difficult to communicate the impact of having to see these images when you're working on these cases. But it's important to understand the impact because it remains abstract otherwise when we're considering this bill. There is nothing in the law now which requires us to copy these pictures and turn them over to the defense. Our requirement is that we disclose them, that we make them available so that they can prepare their case. If they have an expert that wants to take a look at some of the computer information, that's something that can be done. And there are courts that have recognized this, but there are some courts that have done otherwise and gone as far as requiring the state to photocopy child pornography, conduct which would constitute a federal crime. And what's the need? The reason that I make my comment about appreciating the impact of these photos is that the potential damage is so great that all it takes is one mistake for an incredible impact. I think each and every one of us can imagine how traumatic it would be to have the world looking at us in a compromising position. Imagine what that's like for a child who has no one to look after them in that setting. In essence, we're here now at a point where you are the ones who can afford that level of protection to say, you know what, we're not making copies of this stuff. There's another way to do this. Now, suppose the victim is someone who suffers from Alzheimer's, an elderly person, and there's images. And believe it or not, once again, this is a genre fetish that people entertain. What are we doing to stop making copies of this? What safeguards are we putting in place to accomplish that? This information, I can tell you, in Benton County, we've got our evidence right across the street from the courthouse. And we haven't had a problem with our defense consortium or with defense lawyers, coming over and taking a look at evidence. Although it does beg the question, if you will, when we're dealing with child pornography cases, and there is this insistence that they get copies, and we're the ones that have to make those copies. And yes, there are cases that, despite the protective orders, those orders have not been followed. That's occurred in Marion County. I'll defer to Mr. Geyer on that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you. I was asked to come and just share a few stories. I think...
Remember to identify yourself.
I'm sorry.
For the record, thank you.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. Courtland Geyer, Deputy District Attorney, Marion County DA's office. One particular story that I have, again, fairly representative of cases that happen all over. In 2002, I prosecuted a man who had not only possession of these images, but he was charged with some hands-on offenses. The defense attorney made the motion for us to copy the images and provide to them hard copies of the images. We objected. We lost. What was interesting was, in the course of that hearing, this particular defense attorney testified that that she regularly, as a matter of course, gets these and said to the judge that she had a vault back in her office. That was her term, a vault filled with images of child pornography from other defendants that she had represented throughout the years. Her representation was made in order to make the judge feel that this was something that was safe. As has been stated, these images are not only incredibly hurtful but incredibly sensitive because of their electronic nature. While attorneys must regularly take and safeguard privileged information, I would state that this is different. In this particular case, one thing that highlighted the vulnerabilities of this was, at a later stage of the case, this particular defendant went to work for this attorney and worked in her office with this vault. Now, I don't have a horror story ending for you. I have no reason to believe that the images were compromised, but I can tell you that they are still there to this day in her vault. That defendant is in prison as we speak, but the images from that case and others are there unsecured or secured in a manner that is not nearly as safe as if they were secured in the evidentiary locker of a police department with protocols and oversight. If she were to get hit by a car tomorrow, there's simply not the kind of security in place to make sure that those images don't get into the hands of someone who would compromise them. So in that particular case, there was no order to return them. Other cases in my county, there one particular case, I know of for sure there was an order that directed the defense expert to return the images to the police, and they did not. They stated after the fact that they had erased them, but again, the ability of those images to remain in protected areas of the hard drive. I'm not a computer person, but I know that we have recovered images that an offender thought that they had actually deleted. So these stories, I think, are fairly representative of probably what prosecutors who handle these cases every day throughout the state face, and I was asked to share those. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Representative Gelser, Christine Herman, and Attorney General Kroger, please.
Yeah, this is
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which is in Corvallis and Philomath. House Bill 2344 is another of these difficult but necessary conversations that we need to have. House Bill 2344 would protect sexually explicit evidence during the discovery process, and more important, protect the privacy and dignity of the victim during the discovery process. Imagine for a moment that a person has been brutally raped. Now imagine that she has had the courage to take herself to the hospital to have a rape exam. This is an incredibly difficult and personally invasive experience that often involves the taking of dozens of photographs of the very most intimate areas of her body that have already been violated. Now imagine how that rape victim will feel when she learns that the prosecution is required to copy and distribute these explicit photographs and give them over to the defense, including to the individual that she believes has raped her. Once the copies leave the care of law enforcement, there is no way to know what happens to these sexually explicit photos and videos. As you've heard today, we have prosecutors that can talk about how materials may be duplicated, viewed at will by the offender, or even posted to the internet. There was an incident in my community where such materials were distributed to individuals in the community who were not part of the legal team. In this particular case, the victim was an 8-year-old child, and when she learned that the defendant had copied these and shared them with the defendant, her mother, with his family members, the mother of the victim reported that the child became terrified and physically ill when she realized that other people had seen these photographs of her being sexually abused by this individual. In another specific case that my office has heard about, these types of photos were accidentally copied onto the public hard drive at a Kinko's, severely compromising the privacy of a victim. No one here today will question the right of the defense to a full and fair discovery process of all evidence. However, these vulnerable victims do not deserve to be re-victimized by the very system that's charged to protect them. It is very difficult to come forward and participate in a prosecution for reasons that we've discussed earlier today, let alone release personal photos or videos of your genitalia and other intimate areas and risk their reproduction and inappropriate redistribution to others, including the one who has victimized you. Victims have their privacy and victims deserve to have their privacy and dignity respected by the criminal justice system. House Bill 2344 protects the privacy and dignity of the victim while also protecting the discovery rights of the defendant. The attorneys who were going to follow me, but they came before, are going to talk more about this, and there is an exception if the burden on the defendant is too great, if they have to travel too far in order to access the materials. There is nothing in here that would prevent the defense from having access to all of the materials necessary to put up a vigorous and appropriate defense. I was, again, pleased to introduce this bill on behalf of former Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. It is also at the request of a Benton County District Attorney, Dave Amesbury, who's not here today because he is prosecuting a murder, but he was the prosecutor on the case that I referenced earlier where there were materials that were copied and inappropriately redistributed, which basically effectively meant that the child was re-victimized. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today, and I strongly urge you to move this bill forward to ensure that the privacy and dignity of these that are victimized is protected. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. This is a very common sense measure and one I feel extraordinarily strongly about. In the criminal discovery process, prosecutors typically turn over documents and records to defense counsel to use in their office, but we do not provide them with criminal contraband. We don't hand them the drugs or the guns that have been seized. We keep those in a secure law enforcement environment and give the defense counsel, the defendant, any members of the defense team, investigators, an opportunity to come and inspect that criminal contraband. At the federal level, that process certainly extends to things like child pornography. We, at the federal level, as a former federal prosecutor, do not take pictures of child abuse, photocopy them, and hand them to the defense. Instead, we require them to examine those in a secure law enforcement environment. The reason we do that is very simple. Part of it is a concern about taking something that is criminal contraband and placing it in an unsecure environment. If these materials are photocopied or reproduced in the case of electronic media and provided to defense counsel and are in their office, the amount of control over this contraband is very limited. A defense attorney may have all the good intentions in the world, but that may not keep a staff member from failing to show proper respect for this material. It may be reproduced either intentionally or through negligence and redistributed. Even more important, it is extraordinarily harmful to the victims in these cases. And again, Representative Gelser mentioned this, but think about the parent of a child who got caught up in a case where they were sexually abused or got involved in child pornography, and there are photographs, either of their victimized body that were taken at the hospital or the actual photographs of the pornography. Having worked a small number of these cases myself, I will tell you the photographs are deeply disturbing to the point where you'll get physically ill if you look at them. To tell a family that those pieces of evidence, that contraband is not being kept in a secure environment, but reproduced and handed over and placed outside of law enforcement control, is deeply disturbing to those folks. And I think that's why members of the law enforcement community feel very strongly about this bill. I would simply say, finally, this in no way am I suggesting that defense counsel would not take their responsibilities with this material seriously. I'm sure that the overwhelming majority of them do, but the fact of the matter is material sitting in a defense attorney's office is simply not as secure as having them in a secure law enforcement environment where they can truly be controlled. This bill simply brings state practice in line with that in the federal courts, and I think is overdue and would be a fantastic thing for this legislature to adopt. Thank you very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. As has been mentioned, Oregon state law and the United States Constitution both require only that the state make discovery available to the defendant for inspection prior to trial. What we're asking is that we just codify that requirement when it comes to this very sensitive information and very sensitive material. Currently, child and adult victims of crime are afforded little to no privacy with regards to sexually explicit photos, videos, or audio recordings. There is just simply no way to control dissemination of these products after they leave law enforcement. I think we hear pretty regularly about, for instance, laptop computers that are stolen with important information on them. Just yesterday there was a story in the paper about Los Alamos nuclear facility, one of the most secure places in the United States. 69 computers are missing. What we're asking for is a very small inconvenience to defense counsel, one that they're familiar with because they're already doing this procedure with so many other types of evidence. We do not duplicate guns, drugs, physical evidence, biological materials, clothing, fiber samples, etc. There's a procedure in place that all defense counsel are familiar with. They proceed to law enforcement, prosecutor's office, wherever the material is held, to view the material, inspect the material, provide any evidence or expert analysis of the material, and this would remain the same. There is an option in the law for a protective order over these materials. In 2005, the legislature passed a statute that allowed for the state or the victim to request a protective order over the materials before they're disseminated. It was certainly an important step forward in recognizing that this kind of evidence is different and that it is sensitive. However, the problems with the protective order there are several. One is, of course, that that protective order is not automatic, that the prosecutor or the victim have to request it. If the material is ordered to be turned over in discovery under a protective order, it is still copied, it is still duplicated and is handed over to the defense attorney. If there is a dissemination of that material in violation of the protective order, the state would have to prove to the court that that violation was willful, a willful violation of that protective order, which is a very, very high standard. And as I believe Mr. Kroger just addressed, the concern we have is not with defense attorneys not following their rules of professional conduct. It's about that we live in a different world now, and we cannot expect defense attorneys to have the type of security that law enforcement agencies have. Even if material is disseminated in violation of a protective order right now, and the state's able to accomplish that incredible burden of showing that the violation of the protective order was willful, importantly, this provides absolutely no remedy to the victim. The materials are still out there. The violation is still made. The video or the images are still on the hard drive at Kinko's, are still on the internet, are still posted on MySpace. There's absolutely no remedy for a victim. We're asking for your help in protecting victims of crime by asking for a very, very small inconvenience on the defense and allowing, of course, that if there's, for some reason, if the state is not making those materials available, the defense can ask the court for the typical, the more traditional discovery, which is the copying. It's our belief that this small inconvenience will provide an incredible amount of protection for victims, and I think you've heard some of the stories, situations that have happened here in Oregon that we can stop from happening again with this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And maybe it'd be a guess, and my guess is that the question is best directed to you, Attorney General Kroger, or maybe somebody else. The reasonable access, as we would guess it would be interpreted, would that be, you know, going to the locker, checking it out like a library, staying on the premises and looking at it in preparation for trial? Would it mean receiving copies that were redacted with, you know, black boxes and taking them home and so you put them in your file? Something else, either one? I'm just out of curiosity and speaking to the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Smith, the typical practice is that in any situation where you have criminal evidence that can't be disseminated or handed over,
right,
is to provide defense counsel and anyone on the defense team, including the defendant, the ability to come into a secure law enforcement environment. Typically, it's provided to them in a room where they're allowed to spend as much time as they want with the material. In some cases that I've personally been involved in, I mean, that can be a 10 or 15 hour session over a number of days. In no way would a prosecutor, an ethical prosecutor, restrict the amount of time the defense counsel or an investigator needs to review material, particularly if it's voluminous. But it's typically done in a secure law enforcement environment. It's not a question of checking something out and taking it back or redacting. It's viewing.
Right.
And this is very common for firearms, for drugs, for other types of contraband, money, for example.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Chair. So, Christine, it seems that the heart of the issue is we're going from the kind of the protective order system that we passed in 2005, where the state needs to ask the court to put restrictions on this material, to instead making the presumption that the state gets to hold on to the material in their possession, and then the defense would have to make the case why this presumption should be lifted. Is that the gist of it?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, that's exactly right. I should note, too, that in the federal system, the idea of making discovery reasonably available has been litigated, and it is sometimes a fact or a case-by-case basis. It's a fact-based analysis. So there may be situations where reasonably available in one case is different than another. But you're right that the presumption would be that the material will be made reasonably available, and that this that would be upon the burden would be upon the defense if they won't, if they didn't believe it was happening, to bring that to the court and ask for relief.
Mr. Chair, just something that I would add in the case that I had mentioned where the materials were shared with the family member of this child victim. In that case, the district attorney had asked the court to protect the materials and require the defendant and his attorney to come to the district attorney's office to view the materials. The judge denied that order and instead ordered that all of the materials be copied and that reasonable efforts be made to destroy the materials when the trial was over. In this particular case, obviously, the district attorney attempted to use the tool that was available to him. He was denied. And in this specific case, the child was then re-victimized because those materials were intentionally recopied and inappropriately redistributed to other individuals.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Representative Gelser, my understanding is that just how you described that, that's been kind of a consistent problem from Benton County, where the judges have allowed... You know, I mean, in several different cases. That.
Thank you.
Just throw it out there.
Thank you, panel. Next, I have Chris Howard, Gail Meyer, Peter Constantine, Lane Borg, and Andrea Meyer. If you want to, Andrea, pull up an extra chair, please. Please go ahead in any order, identify yourself, and just go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer. I'm the legislative representative on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This bill, House Bill 2344, goes far beyond what is required in the federal statute. And as I make my remarks, I would ask the committee to please... segregate out, really, if you will, two different kinds of evidence that we would be talking about. One would be contraband, and one would be medical evidence, photographs created during the course of the investigation itself. So the Adams-Walsh Act is the one that first drafted the restrictive discovery rights as it related to child pornography. And child pornography is defined within the statute, but basically it relates to pornography that would have the potential of being traded across interstate commerce lines. And it uses the word child pornography, but House Bill 2344 does not employ that language. It does not use child pornography. In addition, then, with the separate kind of evidence and materials that I'm talking about, once there's been an allegation made, a complaint made of sexual abuse, there's an investigation that ensues. In the course of the investigation, a medical exam of the victim is undertaken, and from that medical exam, you have photographs taken of the condition of the victim's body. That also is being subsumed now within the definition here of House Bill 2344. House Bill 2344 is not limited to sexually explicit property. That language is used in the relating clause, and that language is used in the summary, but that language does not appear in the text of the bill. The bill refers to property or material that constitutes or contains a visual depiction or audio recording involving a victim in a state of nudity or engaged in sexual activity. So when you're talking about a visual depiction, meaning a picture, involving a victim in a state of nudity, it involves that second prong of property that I was referencing, which is the medical photographs taken in the course of the investigation. Not something that the defendant possessed or created, but something that was created in the course of the investigation itself. House Bill 2344 uses the same restrictive discovery rights with respect to both different kinds of cases. I would submit to the committee, as I make my comments, that there are different policy analyses with respect to those two different kinds. Both kinds of cases involving child pornography, which I would consider to be contraband, we both can, and cases where there's an allegation of sexual abuse that results in a medical exam, which then results in photographs. Both of those kinds of cases require independent defense analysis. In the computer cases, generally what the law enforcement does, they come in, they have an allegation there might be some internet sexual pornography on a computer, they'll seize the computer. It is possible through the course of an independently retained computer forensic expert to determine the exact time when a photograph is downloaded from the internet into that computer. You can then, cases have been won where they have established that the defendant was at work during the time of the downloading and could not have been the person who downloaded the photograph. I mean, someone did, but it wasn't the defendant. So the defense has legitimate reasons why they're going to need to have a forensic computer examiner come in and examine the hard drive of the seized computer. Similarly, so also with the other kind of evidence where you have a medical examination in the course of investigation, the defense frequently, often, needs to have an independent evaluation of those medical photos. The photos generally would be of sometimes bruising, but most generally it would be of hymenal configuration or anus configuration. In many instances, the medical determination on behalf of the state is that it's inconclusive one way or the other whether or not there's an indicator of abuse. But sometimes there is an opinion from the state that the configuration of those body parts is an indicator of abuse, and so the defense needs to go examine those photos. So in both of these kinds of cases, there's a legitimate reason why the defense would want to have an independent expert examine that kind of property. For years now, and when I say for years, we have been operating under protective statutes. There's been, protective orders. The statute, ORS 135.875, has been in existence since 2005. But we have had protective orders long before then. I would note that the statute, as drafted by the 2005 legislature, is mandatory. It states, when the victim or the prosecution asks for the protective order, it shall be issued. I'm not aware of cases that don't have protective orders. I'm sure that, we've heard some of the testimony otherwise, but amongst the defense bar that is here at this table, quite frankly, they're automatic, quite frankly, almost in the instances that we're aware of. Well, what's wrong with the Adams-Walsh standard and what's the difficulty with it? It does turn discovery on its head. The practices are generally in civil law as well as in criminal law that there is a mutual sharing of documents and whatnot. Challenges have been made to the Adams-Walsh Act, and it's being heavily litigated right now in the federal court. Some courts have found it unconstitutional. It's an undue burden on the defense's ability to prepare its case. Others, most of them, have found that it's constitutional. But the challenges result in extended hearings. So some of the challenges are that the Adams-Walsh provisions are unconstitutional on their face, but then they also result in challenges that they're unconstitutional as applied. So as applied in any one given instance, is there sufficient accommodation made to the defense such that it has not impeded their ability to prepare and independently examine the evidence? We do have a witness here, Mr. Pete Constantine, who is a computer forensic examiner, and he will have other instances of that. My point to the committee here is that this is something that is heavily litigated. It will result in additional hearing time and judicial time because there will be hearings that as applied, it's an undue burden on the defense. I would suggest that this is not always a small inconvenience. If a case were brought in a metropolitan area like Portland, chances are you're going to have the property in Portland, the defense lawyer in Portland, and the expert in Portland. And that may not be of itself that unduly inconvenient. But what of the prosecutions occurring in Ontario or down in Coquille, where the expert is in Portland? Then you have instances where you've got the expert, sometimes court-appointed experts, on state dollars, driving one way. Generally, with respect to the computer analysis, it takes more than an 8-hour shot, so you have to come back in more than one day. You've got overnight. You can delay trials because of this. I'm reminding again that we're peeling off and specifically targeting here criminal actions as opposed to civil actions. If this were a civil action, not only would these provisions not apply, but in addition to that, the defense lawyer in the civil action would have the right to have an independent medical examination of the victim. And so I would question again why the need, in particularly for only a criminal case, if it would not apply with equal measure to a civil action. It's hard as a defense lawyer not to take it personally as an affront to our integrity and professionalism that we can't handle this evidence. And I do note that in the court, once a prosecution ensues, it is the unfortunate fact that these images do get displayed because that is the evidence of the crime. They're displayed, the district attorney has them, they're shown to the grand jury, they're shown to state's experts, and they're introduced at trial. So the question then becomes, how much more significant of a harm is it that it should also be disclosed to the defense? So you will be hearing further testimony from two practitioners here in Multnomah County, where the bulk of sex abuse prosecutions do unfold, and also from Peter Constantine, who is a forensic computer examiner. But in conclusion, I do just want to stress the fact that this is not just the Adams-Walsh Act. Adams-Walsh is limited to child pornography, contraband. This is not. This statute is not limited to sexually explicit material. We do have a protective statute that's mandatory. Those protective orders are issued in almost every case. This will increase costs. It will increase delays. And it will increase judicial time with contested hearings. Thank you.
And we are trying to get out as close to 3 o'clock as we can. People have to be at other meetings, but I want to give you your full time, and we'll, so you have all the time you need.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders, and I've recently come to that role. I've been a practicing attorney for about 24 years. I've taught trial practice for 16 years at Lewis and Clark Law School, and I've also taught lawyer ethics. And I want to, in appreciation, Chair, of your comments, and for brevity, I'll not try to repeat everything that Ms. Myers said, but focus on a few specific things. First of all, I think it's important to understand that Oregon has adopted a different kind of discovery than the federal rules than in other states. Other states sometimes have depositions in criminal cases. We do not. We have a reciprocal discovery statute. We rely on the integrity and the goodwill of the prosecutor and the defense attorney to turn over to each other the evidence that they have, the evidence that they expect to use at trial, and then they can prepare from that. What I expect as an executive director of Metropolitan Public Defenders of my attorneys in going there is not simply to craft a good argument to exonerate their clients. That's their obligation in court. But before that, it's preparing the client. It's discussing what's out there. And the concern I have to House Bill 2344 is that it's going to limit the access and the unimpeded access to that so that they can fully confront with their client what they're going to be confronted in court. Because when I look at this and try to figure out how does this go into practice, what's going to happen? Well, in my 24 years, I've gone into a lot of evidence rooms, but I've never taken my client in custody or even out of custody into an evidence room in the sheriff's office and looked over things. The statute does allow for, you know, that you can do this, but there's case law that says if I bring an expert in, have them look at something, and then they don't appear on my witness list, good chance they're going to appear on the prosecution's witness list. You saw the evidence. What did you see? What happened there? So I've got to think about, do I really bring in an expert to look at that? Or if I have my client sitting in a courtroom or the evidence room, and it's under the rule, there's a law enforcement officer watching them, and they're making comments. I have to say, don't make any comments. Don't, you know, put a hood over your head, because I don't want to risk exposing that situation to having that witness come in. And yet, what I want my attorneys doing is showing them the full brutality of the evidence against them, so that they can come to an honest assessment of whether or not they want to go to trial, or whether they want to plea enter into plea negotiations. And that's going to be impeded, because I can tell you from my own experience in representing clients over many years, some in sex cases, others in other violent felonies, there's a lot of denial out there. And they're going to tell you, oh, it's not there, it's not there. And you want to be able to say, this is what they have. And if I'm having to sit there and filter it, or there's somebody else there, or it's muted, or I got to risk not calling Mr. Constantine because he might find something helpful for the state, and so I don't want to risk that exposure to them, then my attorneys aren't doing the full job that they need to do in really preparing this. And I just, two last points I want to echo is that on the idea of that Ms. Myers talked about the IME in a civil setting. You know, we talk about leveling the playing field, being fair, and all this. In a civil setting, it's not, of course, the individual plaintiff knows who examined them, but that's not the end of the IME, the independent medical examination. It's the ability of the defense to take it and show it to other experts and see, does this really show it? What's our liability here? What's our exposure? What's going to happen to us? And this is going to take that away, because you're always going to be muted by the fact that you're having to look at this in the presence of a sheriff, or the alternative, I suppose, under the statute, is have the courts do it. That's the question to ask when fiscal impact comes in with their impact on it, is what's this going to do to the courts, not just in pretrial motion hearings, but if they start setting up rooms to bring clients over from custody securely to view this stuff, it's going to increase precious space and precious time and cost on that. And my fear, as the executive director of the public defender's office, is that the attorneys will just, not really confront the clients with what is really a raid against them, so that they have an honest discussion before they make that decision to go to trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Christopher Howard again. I'm one of his lawyers. And I want to just talk about some of the practical problems that this bill would create. I spend my days in court crafting pleadings, answering phone calls, clients, district attorneys. I spend my evenings reviewing discoveries, we call it, police reports, photos, those type of things. If I have to go to a courthouse, that's going to be after hours. Same thing if I have to go to law enforcement. Not only does that then mean I'm doing it as extra time to go back and forth, but they have to provide a person that's going to have to supervise me to do that. Same thing with my client. If that's the only time we can go and do that, it really is a terrible inconvenience, because it changed my whole practice around. That's the way everybody around me practices as well. I also like to address a comment about from the Attorney General about these things do not leave the evidence room. There are things that leave the evidence room all the time. They're taken by our experts. They're tested. There are understandings. We call it dealing with the chain of custody, so that there's no problem. We know where it came from. But it's done. Otherwise, we're not able to do a full test. Our experts need to either bring their equipment there, and these settings are not conducive to that. I've been in enough evidence lockers, as Mr. Borg has said. You can't bring in DNA testing there. You can't bring in your own testing for fingerprints, that type of thing. So they have to be taken. So it's done already. It's done in a way that's safe for everybody. This evidence is not disseminated. It's under protective orders by and large, and we take those orders from the court very seriously. We're officers of the court, and we take that responsibility very seriously. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Peter Constantine. I'm a retired federal law officer, having spent almost 25 years of my life as a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Several years prior to my retirement, the DEA funded my training as a forensic computer examiner. When I retired in 95, I started a private practice. I do civil and criminal defense work. Unfortunately, because of the nature of computer crime, the bulk of my criminal defense work is with child pornography cases. I have watched the state of this situation move from no protective order required to a protective order required, and now the possibility of this bill being passed into law, wherein I will be required to go to a law enforcement agency to do my job. That's the way it is now with federal cases, and that has been recently the way it is with some state cases. I can tell you that it is has a greater impact on our citizens and our state than just a mere inconvenience. It can raise the cost for the defense examination to almost, if not twice, what it would cost for the examiner to do it within his office. It takes longer to do the work in someone else's location. Not every law enforcement agency is prepared and equipped to handle this. I'm currently involved in an examination, I'm about halfway through, on a case from the Salem Police Department. This morning I was on the phone. The Salem Police Department does not have the facility for me to go there and do my work. So they struck an agreement with the Oregon Department of Justice here in Salem. They had a facility. I did the first half of the job there. This morning I was on the phone with the Justice Department. They don't have any time for with the facilities available for me to finish. I'm going to have to go back to Salem and tell them they're going to have to come up with a facility. It's going to get expensive for the state's law enforcement agencies. I don't understand the issue of it not being allowed to be done in my office. For almost 25 years of my life, I held a top secret clearance, and at certain times during that period of my life, a higher clearance than that. Now all of a sudden, I'm no longer trustworthy. I don't understand that. And I posed that question to a city judge in Washington County some months back during a protective order hearing. And I from the witness seat, I looked up at him and I asked why it was that it's not furthering the victimization if the law enforcement officers trade this material back and forth, but it is if they give it to me. And the judge sat there speechless. You could have heard a pin drop. After 5 seconds or 8 seconds, he went on to something else. He never did answer my question. So it's more than a mere inconvenience, and it's going to cost the state money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, here to join in opposition to House Bill 2344. You've heard all the reasons. I will not reiterate them. I will let you ask questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I just want to emphasize that the testimony from the district attorneys and so on spoke quite highly, I thought, of the integrity of the defense bar. It was more, they're more concerned about them just being out where somebody else, knowing that the attorneys aren't passing it out, but worried about some staff or something. So I certainly don't think anybody's imputing your integrity or questioning your credibility of taking something and cover, you know, to the best of your ability, not seeing or seeing to it that it doesn't get out.
Thank you.
I don't think people who know the bar are worried about that at all.
Chair Barker, I was remiss in at least not identifying that I did provide the copy of the protective order statute because it's not in the bill. It's referenced in the bill, but it's not there for you to at least see the whole picture of the state of the law right now.
Appreciate that, Ms. Meyer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just got a couple of really quick questions of Peter. How many years were you with DEA?
24.
Just follow up then,
please.
Mr. Chair. How many states have you been involved in during your assignment with DEA?
Oh, my goodness. I'd have to guess. I was assigned to offices in Pennsylvania, Virginia, Texas, and Oregon, but I have worked in probably, I guess, 38 to 40 of the states during my employ, including Alaska, and I did some work down in Bogota, Colombia also.
Okay. Can you give me a ballpark figure how many cases you've probably examined involving pornography of children?
Child pornography cases, ballpark, a reasonable guess, 20.
And then the last question, Mr. Chair. How many cases have you seen, I'm not specifically talking about yours, but other cases where you've seen evidence show up on the Internet?
Material from a case appear on the Internet afterward?
That's correct.
Well, I don't think I can answer that. I can tell you that I repeatedly see the same pictures from one case to another, and most of the stuff is coming off the Internet. But I don't know how I could ever tell that what I'm seeing come in a fresh case has been seen in another case.
Mr. Chair, let me just ask it a little different way then.
Can you clarify, please?
Okay, yeah. What I'm interested in is how many cases are you familiar with that, in fact, not you yourself have been involved in, but have seen where evidence has surfaced on the Internet? I would surely think that you've seen some, you know, with your background.
Where I'm on the Internet and I see child pornography?
No, you're not understanding my question.
Oh, I'm not.
No.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Please clarify.
That's okay.
Okay.
Oh, if you're asking how many cases am I aware of that the evidence has been released, if that's what you're asking, Representative, I know of none.
Well, Mr. I know a bunch, so, and I'm not an expert.
Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
So, and for the record today, we have written testimony on House Bill 2343 submitted by Judge Casey, Dan Norris, Lisa Emory, Jan Friedman, Willamette University students, Lieutenant Jeff Wood and Adam Walsh, and we also have a case from Adam Walsh on 2344. Close the public hearing on 2344. I'm going to carry the work session on 2360 over till tomorrow because people have to be other places. No further business before the committee. We're adjourned.
And there is no committee.